showed me something from the latest Lutheran Standard that is of interest. Creation of a 5-to-7-member task force on spirituality was authorized by the board of the ALC's Division for Life and Mission in the Congregation. As envisioned by the Reverend Donald Burton, a board member from Kenmare, North Dakota, the group will be concerned with how Christians live out their relationships before God in daily life. He also suggested that the task force study how the church relates to movements that are always around, such as cults and Eastern religions. It's interesting that Matthew Fox, at the beginning of, I didn't bring it today, Musical Mystical Bear, says that a pastor of the American Lutheran Church came up to him after a conference and said, spirituality is what's the most lively conversation and interest in the life of churches in America today, and we in the ALC have never even heard or used the term. So the ALC got quoted in the beginning of the book, but as speaking as though they didn't ever use the term. When I first read that, I thought one of the things was that spirituality has been thought of as a kind of Roman Catholic description of things, and that we had discussion of prayer and liturgy and other things without using the term. But I also thought back to my own seminary days, and one time in the senior year on a one-day picnic retreat with the senior class and faculty, did the faculty of the seminary talk specifically and personally about things like daily prayer and devotions. Now that's 4 years of seminary education with very, very little emphasis on the kinds of things that we've been talking about this week. So maybe the American Lutheran Church has not only not had the term, but maybe we've not had a heavy emphasis on this part of our life. I won't say spiritual life, I'll say life. Just one thing that kind of closes off a chapter with Jacques Ellul. This is, I tried to go through thinking maybe I did a disservice to Ellul by selecting and quoting certain things instead of simply encouraging you to read the book. I think this is fairly close to a key theme from Ellul. Prayer, however fervent, spontaneous or new, is never other than a sequel, a consequence, a response to the word of invitation first made known in Scripture. Ellul has a heavy and I think appropriate antidote to prayer being something that we do and initiate and makes it very much a radical response in faith. And I think that that's a thing that's important for us to hear. Also thought it was ironic yesterday that in trying to see a different understanding of spirituality, when we got to prayer, we made it very heavy and ponderous. And I just think that says something about our understanding of things spiritual. I told Karin last night, G.K. Chesterton has a quote, "The unspiritual man can never tolerate the mirth of God." Just throw that in and let that rattle around a little bit. I think we have the assumption that when it's spiritual, we have to be quiet before the session starts, and it really ought to be fairly heavy. Spirituality, including a good belly laugh, I think is somewhat new for us. I have some definitions that I brought today. That would have been another way to kind of keep the week going, is to have definitions, and we could have all brought them in. I thought of that too late. James Carroll, prayer is the act of being haunted by God. Carroll goes a long way with a haunted house and disappointment that we no longer say Holy Ghost. It's a fascinating thing, because when you think of ghosts, you can think of being haunted, and when you get spirit, you kind of get away from the image that was always helpful for me, for him. All right, I'm just telling you that's a kind of poetic way to say it. Fox says prayer is laughter with God. Mysticism is capacity for enjoyment. Contemplation is to search out the simple. Dan Berrigan has a line, prayer is trying to tell the truth. I think that's a fairly helpful one. If prayer is not moments of honesty, and I don't think it'll ever be what it's supposed to be. It's more than that, but start with that. If the times of prayer are the times when I'm talking as though, when I'm talking in a way that I think I ought to, in other words, the unreal times, when I'm more pious than I really am otherwise, I don't think there's ever any hope. It's at least the times when all the masks are off. The one most clearly, the time most clearly when I don't have to fool anybody. Just go down that pike for a while. I think this is a helpful one as we merge into today or move into today. Santayana says, contemplation does not lie in not acting, but in living when I act. All I got was frowns on that one. All right. Contemplation does not lie in not acting. I think there might be an assumption a contemplative is one who sits with a vacant stare. Contemplation does not lie in not acting. It lies in fully living when I act. We'll keep working on it.
Your actions are your life.
And contemplation means my actions are fully alive. Actions are not necessarily life-filled.
No.
Okay.
No, I. No.
How else can we say that? It's not what you're doing, it's what you're doing while you're doing it. Is that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We can try some of those today. The Santayana?
Yeah.
Contemplation is not acting. It's a double negative. Let me see exactly how he said it. Okay. Contemplation does not lie in not acting. Kind of put those two together. But in living when one acts, or being fully alive when one acts. I would like finally to get to the James Carroll poem, which I like very much, which at the end of the chapter that Mary and I did in Things That Make for Peace, when I think of contemplation, I think first of all of this poem. So we quoted it in its entirety. I think one of the only things we did quote it in its entirety. By this time, this being the third day, I assume some of you did not bring it. Let me read it as a way to move us into contemplation today. If you have it, by all means, get it out. And if you have notes beside it, that's what we want to share. Like ourselves, when we try to love each other, air blows cold and hot. We are left wondering if our passions were mistaken, if our loneliness is, in the end, everything. And God, like ourselves, when we are distant and close at once, he confuses us. Like ourselves, he begins his story with an eye-catching title, then fools us, fading, leaving us asking if this pain we cannot avoid, though we try, is yearning after him or yearning only after yearning. Is God my pious name for guilt, as the doctor keeps telling me by the way he holds his head? You ask, how do you pray when it's all so foggy? But it's not foggy at all, don't you see? It is clear as air, prayer. How I pray is breathe. I remember the poet Paul, who couldn't shake the faith either, saying, praying, forget praying. The Spirit, breath of God, lives in you, in your bones, in your heart, interrupting God for you all day. Relax, don't worry about it. The Spirit prays for you with sighs too deep for words. Paul, baby, I could kiss you for those lines, which come, I suspect, more from your insane desire like mine than from any facts you had. Sighs like that I know about. If you tell me those sighs are the breath of God praying, I can believe it, I can believe it. My sighs are warm and cool, death and life, far and near. My sighs always surprise me, for a sigh is what happens when the breath I breathe is not all mine. How I pray is breathe, knowing the air that brings the world into my soul escapes its hedge with more of me than I knew was there. What kind of spirituality does Jim Carroll have in order to write that poem on prayer? Faith. What in the light of the poem, how do you feel that? What form does it take? What what's the substance of his faith? Or, you know, can you?
Well, I was thinking in terms of what you had introduced before, in and about faith, that it's a response to the word.
All right.
He's really talking about a scriptural verse from Paul.
Yes, right.
About prayer.
Right.
And he's talking about he's lived that those words out in his own way, and he sees that they're a little bit the same, and he can write it in another way.
Okay, all right. He
lightly.
Pardon?
I think it's a light.
Light.
In a way.
All right. Not ponderous. Okay. And he sees the way Paul sees, which is the essence of having the word speak. He not only knows what Paul says, but he has had an experience the same way, and so he's saying he's
convinced, I think.
All right.
Convinced.
Other people.
Well, the little section that I saw is relating to the spirituality. The very bottom, the spirit, breath of God lives in you, in your bones, in your heart, interrupting God for you, all day. So that spirituality is a part of you all the time. It isn't
okay.
A state that you jump in and out of.
All right. Okay. We yesterday could have taken pray without ceasing. And tried to understand what that could mean and what it says prayer is or isn't. I mean, there are, unless it's something like a natural consciousness breathing, if it's a conscious activity verbally, you can't pray without ceasing or you'll bumble through life and not, I mean, you'll be a basket case. You won't be able to answer someone or so that it has to have some reference to an awareness, not an activity like talking. I mean, it can't be limited to that. All right. So you have, and God as the initiator of it, instead of us as the initiator of it. All right. It's the breath of God interrupting God. Does that make any sense?
It's real curious to me. What's he mean, interrupting? Getting his attention?
Only poetic?
What do you mean by only poetic?
That doesn't have to be answered.
What do you mean by?
I don't use the phrase.
I think poetry can say, interrupt God without the requirement for somebody saying, does that mean when I say a prayer or when I breathe, God is stopped in his activity and suddenly gets interrupted in a literal sense? I think you can say poetically, figuratively, allegorically, and I don't have any special meaning to what the poetic was, but I think you have poetic license, and I think the truth primarily, I think scripturally, the truth is primarily poetic in the sense that I'm using it, and not literal, or at least I think it's at least as clear a conveyor of truth as literal history. Yeah.
I don't know if it would interest anyone, but every time I read that phrase, I keep on reading it, interpreting instead of interrupting.
Interpreting.
I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I know why.
Why?
It's spelled almost the same, but that's what I think of.
It's interesting.
continually being aware of God, sort of interpreting it, continually being aware.
I read it that way the first several times.
Did you? What's the stuff of faith in all of the, in Jim Carroll's whole book? Do you know the title of the book?
Elements of Hope.
Elements of Hope. And what are the elements of hope?
Air, fire, water, and...
Earth, air, earth. Fire, and water. That, is that say anything about spirituality, that it's the stuff of this earth that you find as the elements of hope? I think that's one of the clearest parts. How do you feel about like ourselves when we try to love each other, air blows cold and hot? How do you feel about spirituality when you start with human examples as an understanding of how God works? Does that offend you? Does it offend your theology?
Well, he's not saying that God blows cold and hot. It seems that way to us. That's maybe I'm putting my own... Air blows cold and hot, like ourselves we eat air. Yeah.
And where does God fit into that?
Well, God seems distant and close at once. And over here, well, and he confuses us, but that's not his fault. Is it? That's our problem.
All right.
How about their ears have been stopped or their hearts have been hardened so that they may not understand the parables?
I think something where God did that.
I don't know.
I think something real key is the last word on the bottom of the first column, relax.
Mm-hmm.
Because he starts out with images of people like flies against a screen, you know, bumbling around, missing one another completely. It's our desire, it's our yearning after yearning for God. And it seems also foggy, and then he says, it's as clear as day. Relax.
But then that's always been the message of the mystic. The mystic can see it. He tells everybody else, relax. Mm-hmm. It's out there. You know, I know it's real. But it's not always that easy to hear.
Mm-hmm. One of the sections that I think is an important one for spirituality or for our discussion. Sighs like that, I know about. If you tell me those sighs are the breath of God praying, I can believe it. Mm-hmm. If you tell me that what I did was prayer, you mean that's it? I don't have to go to school. That's really what we're talking about, but that's kind of a hard... We so often take that what we have, if we have come to faith, we now have a commodity. And we can choose to share that, we can choose to share those riches with other people or choose not to. And so we have that heavy burden of whether or not we're going to share it, where in essence, all we're asked to do is not to bring our riches to them, but to point out the riches they already have. And the gospel breaks through when you say, oh, you mean that's me? Yeah. And our evangelism is too much that you pick up people who are knocked down. In fact, you read it. And if they're not down, there's nothing you can do, so you have to knock them down so you can pick them up. The only way we can function. We can't really go and say, no, that's it. The riches are yours. And not to have a kind of, I've got it, you don't have it, so let me help you. I don't know how to say that without still some confusion, but I think we've got... I got it.
He has a section at the beginning. He says something about prayer is helping us to become, in prayer we become what we already are, what God knows we are. Is that the same thing?
Very close. Right.
I'm not sure I understand exactly.
I just think there's lots of things behind it. I think it's personal and not self-centered. I think that's very hard to get a feel when somebody has written personally and not so self-consciously or so self-centeredly. I think part of the thing when something is ponderous is when it's missed that kind of balance. Obviously, the prayer is not essentially verbal. Sigh is too deep for words. I don't know what it does in the way of your understanding of faith, but if something really comes more from your insane desire like mine than from any facts you had, that's at least some way to talk about the leap of faith. Or, okay, well, I'm sorry we didn't get to it the first day when you probably had read it and still have it in front of you. We want to move with those kind of shifts from Ellul to James Carroll's poem to that which I would say up on the board anyway in the two columns that we've been using. The one word more than any other is aware. If spirituality is to be aware, it seems to me that even though, and I still read and find little clarity between meditation and contemplation. We've tried to have some with meditate to think deeply or reflect and contemplate to look intently or to gaze, and if that's helpful, all right, but I think you'll find people intermingle that. It's to ponder, to become aware in new ways, to be more open to life, but I think that the two are confused, and I hope that instead of now having three compartments, prayer, meditation, and contemplation, that they expand the understanding of the totality and not become new ways in which you get separated out from it. One of the things that we just touched upon, Eric touched upon it, and then I said that maybe that's another way to look at transcendent. What did you say, Eric, when we got to transcendent? That it wasn't necessarily a heaven or an up, but it was a
transcendent attitude, okay, rather than in the physical world.
I tried to pick up some notes on what could be transcendent living. If spirituality has a measure of transcendence, especially in meditation or contemplation, if it is both being radical, going back to the roots, and has the heights and the depths, then it's the opposite of superficial living, the surface of things. It's a personal example. It seems to me that in the spirituality that includes a heavy emphasis on justice, then that ought to affect all of the things that we talk about, even contemplation and meditation. So I tried to see if certain people had a consistent spirituality. Here's James Carroll. The rediscovery by the church of its fundamental identity as a worshipful people is not a flight from social or political responsibility. On the contrary, once we start praying again, once we take seriously the contemplative vision that we are heirs to, we become more socially and politically restless than ever. It's the American denial of our own best dream. It's built on the premise that no one sees beneath the surface of things. No one sees behind the TV screen. If the whole gathering of people begin to see with what Rozak calls eyes of fire, then everything social and everything political is called into question. Far from amounting to a surrender of involvement in social change, the commitment to a religious, worshipful, contemplative way of life is a profoundly political act with specific implications for everything from prison reform to exploitive trade practices. And Carroll quotes Gandhi, "Anyone who tries to do an act of religion that is not political understands neither religion nor politics." If contemplation and meditation are to get below the surface of things by going down or by lifting up, then it really calls into question that we spend so much of our time and energy in a kind of horizontal thinking. Let me bring you a quote. I'm just going to have a couple things to trigger some sharing on meditation first. For Merton, renunciation of the world must be considered essentially as an unmasking of an illusion, namely the one, namely the unmasking of one's own alienated and false self. Therefore, man's flight from the world becomes in reality a flight from the selfishness of his own empirical self. In this sense, Merton primarily uses the expression the world, and for him it signifies not the created universe, we've talked about that before, but those people who love the transient and unimportant things and who are therefore self-centered and ego-centered. If you can break through that the rejection or the renunciation that the monk calls for is for those who live on that surface of things, and therefore their world is too much on the surface. Those who have rejected God's love, to renounce the world means not only to leave the world, to live apart from the world, it's to follow ways that differ from those of the world and devote oneself to a life of prayer which has as its end the glory of God in all things. Vertical thinking gets below the easy dogmas and habits that we have. It drags us to the edge of a deepness that we do not understand. People have tried to say it in different ways. The practices, then, of meditation. There are more books on the practices of meditation than there are on contemplation. Include things like, what do you suppose is a book on the practice of meditation? What would you expect to find here?
What would we expect to find? Like instructions?
Instructions in what?
How to sit.
How to sit.
Mm-hmm. Lights, heat.
Lights.
Quiet.
Solitude and silence.
How to breathe.
Breathing. Exercises, Marking. Even. All right, chants, right? The purpose for all of those. Let's just assume that we've accepted our paradigm and that they are not to flee from the world or from reality. What role do those things, what legitimate role do those things have? There are just tons of books on those things, and some of them I think are helpful. But what would you expect to be finding from them? Why would it be important that there's a certain way that some people have found helpful for their bodies, posture and centering during times of meditation? I mean, is it keep your mind off of yourself? All right, let's get the simplest of illustrations. Why do you think it ever started that you folded your hands when you prayed?
So that you weren't doing something.
So that you were not distracted. Okay. All right. Have any of you ever sat in a full lotus position or a partial lotus position for prayer?
I drove a Maserati once.
That's close.
That's close.
Did it help? No one ever has? You've never gone to...
Yeah, I have.
All right.
I was very distracted.
Distracted because, all right. Did somebody instruct you in that, and so that you were trying a form of meditation, and what did the instruction say was the advantage of that as a position?
The whole circular concept, the way my body was placed,
or feeling centered,
mm-hmm.
Balanced.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard Jana speak much about what yoga, the relationship between her own meditation and yoga. One of the things that's part of the spirituality that we're talking about, you remember there was a criticism of the definition, prayer is lifting up heart and mind to God. One of the questions Fox asked was, what about the body? If you leave an important part of you out, you really are saying something about prayer being only a mental attitude. But most of the things that I'm recommending to you would say that there is not one bodily position, that's it. It's that you find your own way in which you center down, or and if the bodily position helps in that. I think it should be as common sense as if you tend to conk out in sleep and really want to ponder, then if you're going to lie down on a bed, you probably are not going to ponder very long, and you're kidding yourself to say that's a good bodily position for me. If you want to relax, including sleep, then get in a position that's conducive to sleep. In other words, don't make your comments and your understanding of meditation outrageous compared to common sense as to what makes some sense. How about solitude? What role does that play? What is solitude to you? How would you start? Separating yourself from other people or being alone. All right, it's more than that, but that's a start. Is that important for meditation? And
when you practice, it's not supposed to be. You're supposed to be able to sit in a total crowd and within half a minute feel some kind of a meditative state or achieve some kind of meditative state. I can't do that. Mm-hmm. It's important for me now, my naive state.
Do people here have more than... There are times when I just have to get away. All right. I've heard that many times at home. There are some times when I just, in fact, the staff last summer said, if you live in the lodge and you have a roommate, there are some days going out and taking a hike helps, but it would be nice if there was a room where the attitude was that was a quiet place. Even the reference library or the meditation library is not a quiet place. Some freedom from the necessity of visiting and sharing and being with people. All right. Are there people here who practice some kind of regular form of meditation that includes consciously getting away, not only when psychologically you feel, I just got to get away from people for a while, which is also very legitimate, and I think part of spirituality, but are there people here who consciously have a time apart daily as part of what you call your spirituality? A couple people. What does it say if that's not part of our general understanding toward our own devotional life, prayer life? Does it say we've progressed?
It may be part of our understanding, but we may not do it. I'm very envious of people that somehow are able to do it, because I'm not, and I've been trying for years, because I really do think that would be helpful for me.
Joyce?
Sometimes, though, when you're all alone, you can't think either. You can't just settle down and think and be solitude like that. So it doesn't necessarily have to, you don't have to go away from people.
Pascal.
That most people are unhappy because they can't stand the thought of being in a room by themselves. To have to face your own self and your own emptiness is pretty tough for a lot.
Do you think we fear being alone? Is that part of it?
It's one of Paul Green's
it's a big thing in the survival syndrome.
All right. Some of you have heard me say before, in the monastery, it is consciously, deliberately boring so that you're faced with yourself. There's a conscious attempt not to keep you entertained, because they feel that one of the things that's important is to come to terms with the desert, which is within you, or to deal with yourself. That can also be very self-centered. But I think most of our life is far from that. The assumption that to be fully alive is the key thing in the spirituality. But it's possible that we lose ourselves in being always with other people and always being active. Now we're coming back to what I think Santayana meant, Karen. It's not just that we find life in activity, but that the activity is really full of life and not an avoidance of life. And I don't know how one knows that. I mean, those are all kind of heavy words and but do you feel the difference between that? So that activity can really be a way of avoiding life. This is again a quote from Merton on solitude. It is clear to me that solitude is my vocation, not as a flight from the world, but as my place in the world. Merton knew that the truest solitude could not be something that was necessarily outside of himself, the mere physical state of being alone or apart from noise and other people. I think that's what we think of first, and I think that's a first step. But it must be something within you, that's what Gary's saying, an abyss opening up in the center of your soul where you come face to face with yourself in the lonely ground of your own being. And for Merton, it's primarily being stripped of any illusory image of himself, rather to realize the true inner dimension of his being. By discovering this sense of his own personal integrity and his own true reality, he would then be more ready for the gift of himself to others. Thus, for Merton, it's best described as the solitude of detachment, a solitude which empties our hearts and isolates us from the desires and ambitions and conflicts and troubles and lusts common to the children of the world. As such, solitude does not necessarily mean a withdrawal or separation from other people. It's rather a renunciation of the deceptive myths and falsities that alienate someone from God, from himself, from others, and thus prevent him from finding them in the truest sense. For this reason, Christian solitude, according to Merton, is never a solitude from people, but a solitude for people. I think Karen String read that before she left. You will also find in meditation that there is a great emphasis on silence. I would simply remind you that in the writings of the writers that are considered the experts in spirituality, there are levels of silence or kinds of silence that are mentioned. And by mentioning them, I'm not sure that it answers all your questions about them, but let me share with you what we put in the book on contemplation and silence. Maybe I can't find it. Yeah. The first meaning of silence is also the first thing that's spoken about. That's namely the cessation of speech. You want silence? You stop talking, or you get away from the transistor radio, or you get part noise can also be a way to avoid life. Okay. The second is the silence of the mind, and that one's harder, obviously. You can't just shut off the distracting thoughts, but it seems to me that it's possible that at some point, by developing some disciplines, I mean, we're talking about, are there things that we do, or again, is this all what God does? It seems to me that if prayer is a gift and a response to God, and we're primarily seeing God as the initiator, that there are some things we can do to make the climate possible where that gift takes place. I mean, if you never stop talking, I'm not sure you have a right to say, well, God never gave me the gift of silence. The silence of the mind is the kind of slowing down of all the distracting thoughts. Again, if techniques aren't helpful for you, maybe sharing of what some people have found as helpful sometimes comes as a word of encouragement. I have a friend who has an hour of time alone for his pondering daily. It's an important part of his discipline. Doesn't mean everybody needs it, but he has found that he does. And he has a piece of paper there, a tablet next to him. The only reason the tablet is not to write down for publication all the great insights he got. He's never done that. The tablet is for the distracting thoughts, because he found when he first started, and he wanted a time to ponder some things freed from the typical racing of his mind, that the first thing that would come to his mind is, don't forget to call Jim at 10 o'clock, he was a businessman, about such and such. So he wrote that down so that he could forget it. So he didn't have to keep that in his mind. All right. Very simple kind of thing he came to. Well, I think the advantage of some books or sharing is that people have found some things helpful, and if they help you, okay. The The third level of silence is the silence of the will, and that's described in various ways. In Protestant hymnology, it's "Thou art the potter, I am the clay." It's, how often in a lifetime do people really feel that there is a presence of God, that they feel united with the source of all being, some kind of ecstatic experience. But in the writings of mysticism, that's the third level of silence, and obviously those who went into some kind of full-time call to be monks or contemplatives had that experience as one of their hopes. Whether that helps ever have the experience or not, I don't know. The end of the section where we describe those three, I said that might help some to say that there are three stages of silence. What even more helpful for me is a description of anti-silence. That is, the description is, anything which numbs the senses and the source of life. That's more helpful to me. If you want silence, one of the ways to know what it is to see the opposite of it. Anything which numbs the senses and the source of life. I guess what I'm saying is some reason to talk about deciding some form of meditation or contemplation is, I think, if you make no attempt to do it, that most of our life tends to numb the senses and the source of life. That so much of life is both distracting and filled with noise and filled with the kind of busyness that keeps you from the vertical or the transcendent living. I think just leaving everything alone will live on the surface of things and not be able to break through those. Obviously, another form of meditation in the book, and I'm not trying to turn you off to books like this. In fact, this is a fairly good one. Is the meditation or the gazing at or the pondering of an object. I remember went on a 3-day thing on meditation, and at every session there was a candle in the middle of the thing. It attracted your attention. It's an old kind of common focus of attention for a group that wants to meditate. I think that the religious architecture, church architecture, focal point, Bill Turner's icons, mm-hmm. in Russian Orthodox things, even Jesus saying, "Consider the lilies of the field." I don't think you have to think of something esoteric. In fact, in the spirituality that we're talking about, the more common and the more the stuff of the earth they are, the more consistent it is. Not to get out of this world, but to find new meaning as you bust through this world or as you become alive to this world. Let's move to
In the American descent of interpretation of Eastern meditation, there's primarily two forms. One is sensory deprivation and another is sensory expansion. They're both for quieting and becoming, putting oneself in another perspective, in a deeper perspective. And for me, that's how I use meditate and contemplate, for those two forms. Sensory deprivation, one is meditate, where I try and make the mind a blank gray wall. So absolutely nothing on the mind, so that something can flow in, something important. And contemplation is where I try and be as aware through all 5, 6, or 7 senses as possible of whatever it is, a candle, or wherever I happen to be sitting. And by quieting my explanations, interpretations, relations between those things, not putting an overlay of thoughts on them, but just experiencing what comes in through the senses, then allowing a larger meaning to come in, mm-hmm. that way. That's how I use meditation.
Do you grab that? You understand that?
Mm-hmm. That's different than the definitions we've got up there.
Somewhat.
Sort of, but one is thinking and one is gazing, looking.
Yeah.
But reflecting, which is one of the definitions for meditation there, you know, which for me was a primary
motivation for being here didn't come as that's looking back and trying to make some sense out of, which is almost completely the opposite of what the way you defined it for me. So that was a curve for me. Okay, I've been trying to sort out the distinction between the two, and while I understand the deprivation and the heightening part, to link it the way you did to those two terms muddied the waters for me.
Other reactions or comments?
I had a Messianic Jew student this summer. That's like a Jew for Jesus, but he called himself a Messianic Jew because he didn't like the Jew for Jesus sect of the Messianic Jews. Who was saying, and I didn't know what to respond really, he was saying that meditation in the Eastern sense of emptying the mind and of trying not to have any thought of any thought that would come, you kind of throw it out to the point where your mind is totally emptied, has throughout Christian tradition and history and Hebraic tradition and history, which he was much more versed in than I was, been associated with necromancy and black magic and all the bad things. And that Christian contemplation and meditation is something always other than emptying the mind. It's always Christ-focused or God-focused or word-focused, and insists on not creating a void for all the evil spirits to come into.
Have you?
I read some 15th, 16th century writings on English writings on meditation, and they always suggested beginning with some aspect of the gospel, a scene from the gospel, an occurrence from the gospel, and that was very important. So you wouldn't have an empty mind.
It's an interesting notion, though, coming from real fear, as if through our mind we could keep out evil thought or evil energy. You know, the fear of, oh no, if my mind is left open and blank, something might come in. And the defensible against that would be then to think and fill the mind. Is that what?
Fill it up with junk.
Or is that not what it's saying at all?
He would say, fill it up with God or fill it up with the Word.
There's the one parable of the cleaning, sweeping the house, and then the last state of the man was worse than the first because seven demons came to the empty house. I mean, there's one New Testament story. I think meditation, well, you Bonhoeffer people, what's meditation for Dietrich Bonhoeffer? There's a chapter called Meditation. What does it consist of in the Christian community?
Scripture.
All right. Yeah, basically a response to scriptures.
Yeah.
Reflecting on and pondering. In fact, even reading scriptures differently. If I remember Bonhoeffer, if the preacher meditates on scriptures, he's not thinking about writing the sermon or giving the lecture. It's where he personally is coming to the mirror of God's word or something, right?
Right.
That you even read it differently. You chew it in that old, you know, inwardly digest it, you ponder it, you might spend 15 minutes on a verse. You're not reading for comprehension. So in much of Christian tradition, I think the Jewish part I don't know that much about in the Old Testament. I don't know the Jewish practices of meditation in the Old Testament. Does anybody? I mean, the Psalms and that are very much the history of God's action with his people. Very concrete and historical.
They could meditate on that day and night.
Yes.
They could, like you said last night, I guess, recite over and over and over and over the works of God, the acts of God in the past.
Let me move to a couple different things. Yes, go ahead.
Well, what I didn't say is I feel kind of uncomfortable with that in a way, because I feel like there is... It's hard for me not to believe that there would be something very salutary about emptying the mind. Just because I'm in such a strong reaction against the busyness and the noise in the broad sense of our society, that it seems to me that, and also the fact that it's so hard to do, also seems that it's probably a good thing. times that I've tried tried to empty my mind and, you know, done a half an hour meditation without any source of material to fill it, like the scripture verse or the name of Christ, or, you know, and without anything to try to fill that void, has been very, very hard for me. But it seems like a kind of a challenge that's exciting, and it would be helpful if I could do it. The people that advocate that say it is indeed helpful and salutary, that it lowers your blood pressure, it does all kinds of fantastic things for you, it gives you a very good sense of well-being when you're done. I mean, they can go on for books extolling the fantastic benefits that does for the individual and does for the society, does for a corporate group, by just being able to clean your mind out and not think for a while.
And yet there's no connection there with anything, what we've been talking about as far as how that connects us with other people.
Well, it puts you in touch with the ultimates of the universe and gives you sympathetic vibes with all your other brothers that are doing the same thing. You can do it corporately as well as personally.
No, I guess I don't mean the need for it to be corporately, but the idea of contemplation or meditation, not as withdrawal from the world, but withdrawing into the center of the world, you know, closer in. The kind of meditation that you were describing.
If it revitalizes you, then it revitalizes you for this involvement, then it seems like that's valid.
Maybe it makes you more aware of the world because you're finally getting quiet enough.
Maybe, but I think it's a real hazy maybe. Maybe it gets you more in touch to do something else too. That's even more self-centered. I don't know.
Anybody here do transcendental meditation? Or have a mantra? There were people on staff this summer who did. No one here has ever been to a transcendental meditation?
I've been to some workshops.
What was your impression of?
My impression of meditation?
Of the workshop?
I have not been to TM workshop.
Oh, okay.
I have been to similar, they call them self-hypnosis to get away from,
right.
It's conducted very scientifically to get away from the supernatural, the levitation type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I've been to the initial TM stuff, and I've also read some of the techniques. I think they're published in Psych Today or something. It caused a big uproar because for free you could buy Psych Today and get essentially the same techniques that you could pay $60 or $120
right.
to go to TM. And some of my family has been to the TM, and my initial reaction is, oh, that's great, Mom, you're learning to relax, you're taking some time out for yourself. My secondary reaction was, please don't stop there. I sort of felt like that was a 50% deal.
Mm-hmm. There are some people who say that the Jesus prayer, which was repeated just over and over and over again, is essentially a mantra. I mean, that finally that doesn't have, it doesn't bring a lot of theology, it finally clears the mind. Well, I don't know.
Jesus, what is that?
Jesus Christ, Lamb of God, have mercy upon me. And they said that thousands of times. The Jesus prayer is a kind of mantra. And so some people say that's Christian. Other books, Augsburg publishes books that warns against TM as a false religion and all of it. It certainly Eastern in its orientation. But they say it's just a practice of meditation and does not have a theological content to it.
A problem I have, which Libby mentioned, with a lot of the current practice of meditation, commercialized meditation in this country, is that they do stop at well-being. That's
yes.
all you're expected to
yes.
achieve. And what I like, the times I consider in the deepest, I'm meditating the deepest, are prior to writing a poem. And that is useful for me because I move from a state of calm into dealing with a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel better equipped to wrestle with the problem when I have some calm, when I've blocked out irrelevant matters,
mm-hmm.
and I've more focused, I've got a better perspective on it. And sometimes, you know, sometimes a good poem comes out of it, sometimes an answer comes, not an answer as such,
mm-hmm.
but a wrestling with the problem. A proper phrasing of the question comes out of it. And that, I think that's necessary for meditation to be Christian meditation. You've got to consider one of the problems that is raised by the gospel or by your involvement with it. Not settle it. Consider. So I would say you can't go into it with an empty mind, come out of the empty mind, and go back into ordinary life and call it quits.
Okay. Somewhat similar to the passage we read the other day about Christians and mysticism, and if the prophecy, if the justice issue is part of it, yes. If it's a moving away from some, it's easily become self-centered.
It's another thing of this world that can be used by God, used by Satan, and that's the question. There's a really good book on the subject if you want to get into it. It's called The Awareness Trap, the thing you're talking about, of just making it all the various awareness movements, the TM and the EST and the this and the that, you know, all, I don't even know what they all are, drugs, all that stuff to try to heighten your own self thing. This guy is a sociologist and says this is all just a personal trap and distorts the corporate nature of humanness.
There is a Jesuit priest who was impressed by parts of the Zen meditation. It's called Christianity and Zen. Christian Zen, all right. It's very easy to read. It's helpful. There is Simplicity Day by Day. Is that the name of it by Tilden Edwards?
Living Simply Through the Day.
That's a brand new one here. Tilden Edwards is a friend of ours from Washington, D.C., an Episcopal priest, I think.
There's one in the bookstore now called by Bill Hume. It's Your Potential and Your God, and he takes all the human potential movies and a bunch of other things and shows how they relate or don't to. I think. I haven't read it. I think that's it.
So it doesn't seem, there have not been many people who've asked questions in this area this fall. I think if anything, we tend to put down part of what those movements are saying is lacking in our spirituality. In other words, I think we have some things to learn from those. And normally, a movement like that gets as much interest as it does and becomes somewhat successful because it's moving into an area which has been neglected by Orthodox religion, or in other words, it can appeal precisely because the feeling level and the body as part of prayer and a sense of community and affirmation is missing. Then they capitalize on that. So I think there's usually something that you can learn from it. I want to share a couple things on contemplation, and then we had the one Jim Carroll poem, but let me share a couple others with you. It is the business of creation to make God concrete without apology. We need not return to Eden or forget the cities we have made or murder our machines to speak of God without blushing. The wind is not embarrassed, both to turn turbines and whisper of presences beyond. Water can wash engines and lay quite still, beguiled by what it knows of peace. It is neither an old nor newer world we need, but a way of seeing what clings to the underside of everything, man-made or found. The question clings as well, the only one in the end as in the beginning, how to meet and learn to love the one whose terrible splendor goes far beyond our poor but only word, God. The earth, the wind, the fire, the rain, unless they lie, and our blindness is true, bid us wait here, bid us wait and watch with care. That's a contemplative poem. And one other one. This is a new way of seeing, and Gary asked the first day, does that mean not only physically gazing, but a new way of seeing, meaning understanding or perceiving? And there's a series of ways in which we are disillusioned. The reason that I'm reading this poem is that both Thomas Merton and James Carroll have as the primary function of contemplation within their own spirituality, they're not saying the dictionary is wrong, but with their own spirituality, being disillusioned. Seeing some different world. It's not primarily heavenly visions. It's not retreat from reality.
but it's seeing this world differently. And the reason that's necessary, the reason that the Spirit of God and a new understanding and a metanoia or a repentance or a new birth, or it's because this world is full of illusions. So that you're seeing this world differently. That's what contemplation is for Merton and James Caird. And they really are writing about that most of the time. I want to share a couple things from Merton. Learning is no utility's hoard of packages of meaning, but it is what happens when you grow. Work is not the drudgery of wages, but how we build the world. Law is not the leveling of differences, but how we celebrate them. Leisure is not recovering from effort for the next one's sake, but contemplation for its own. Mind is not merely means to possession and power, but a way to stand under the world. Erotic love is no escape from fear, but man and woman, fearful for each other. Family is not an isolated fortress, but the common gift to every life. Religion is not a trick played on God, but a language for speaking mystery. Friendship is not a device for promotion, but it's the company of failures. Solitude is not an interlude of presence, but the shadow of eternity. Freedom is not self-grandeur, but a chance for reckless service. Earth is not a road to other worlds, but the simple start of heaven. He has many times when he tries to get into some kind of disillusioning process, and he does it mostly verbally. Let me share a couple things with Merton, then we'll quit for the day. Merton is afraid of the word contemplation. He's afraid primarily for this reason, and it's in his introduction. The worst disadvantage of the word is that it sounds like a something. Contemplation. So you immediately... an objective quality or a spiritual commodity that someone can procure. You have a lecture on contemplation. I want some of that. I'll go. How do I get some contemplation? We almost had to say the same thing about prayer. There are people who pray. That's all you can really say about it. But it's right. Something that it would be good to have. Something which, when possessed, would liberate me from problems and from unhappiness. I want to add contemplation, as if there were a new project to be undertaken among all the other millions of projects suggested to us in our lifetime. Now there's a new one, to become contemplative. Right. Having said that he's afraid of that, he writes a book on new seeds of contemplation. I think it's fascinating, and I did not realize this until I opened up and reread the first. Listen to our paradigm of spirituality. Contemplation is the highest expression of man's spiritual life. It is that life itself, namely that the spiritual life itself, fully awake, fully alive, and fully active. Awake, aware, and spirited, right? So if the first page of the book, if you want to say what paradigm is Merton coming from, you've got a very good clue. It is spiritual wonder. It is spontaneous awe at the sacredness of life and being. Contemplation is above all awareness of the reality of the source of life. It knows the source inexplicably. I always have trouble with that. With a certitude that goes both beyond reason and beyond simple faith. Contemplation is a kind of spiritual vision to which both reason and faith aspire. I want to read some things that contemplation is not. In some ways that's easier to make that list. It's not the contemplation of abstract ideas. It's not something to which we can attain alone by intellectual effort, by perfecting our powers, a kind of self-hypnosis resulting from concentration on our own inner spiritual being. It's not the fruit of our own effort.
Contemplation cannot be taught. It cannot even be clearly explained. It can be hinted at, suggested, pointed to, and may be symbolized. It is not inertia or a tendency to inactivity. It is not psychic peace. The contemplative is not a person who likes to sit and think, still less one who sits around with a vacant stare. Contemplation is much more than thoughtfulness or a taste for reflection. Now, does that make it different from meditation? Contemplation is not a trance, and it's not ecstasy. It's not the hearing of sudden, unutterable words, nor the imagination of lights. Let us hope. Let no one hope to find in contemplation an escape from conflict, from anguish, or from doubt. Contemplation is not a painkiller. This is a line that really doesn't have a lot to do with contemplation, but it has a lot to do with what we did the last 2 days. Our idea of God tells us a lot more about ourselves than it does about God. For whatever that's worth. Whatever is demanded by truth, by justice, by mercy, or by love must surely be taken to be willed by God. To consent to his will is then to consent to be true, to speak truth, or at least to seek it. Dan Berrigan. Praying is trying to tell the truth. We do not detach ourselves from things in order to attach ourselves to God. Remember the two paradigms? Mm. Rather, we become detached from ourselves in order to see and use all things in and for God. Say anything to you? Okay. That was the last one I was in.
Can we do that again?
All right. We do not detach ourselves from things in order to attach ourselves to God. You don't flee from the world in order to find God. Rather, we become detached from ourselves in order to see and use all things in and for God. Merton even has a distinction between denunciation and renunciation. It isn't that we denounce, it's the freedom to say no in order to really be free. It takes a while to read in writings to understand detachment. I have a very negative first impression when I read detachment. It sounds like you're somehow not really yourself, and that isn't what they mean by it. What we'd like to do tomorrow is a couple exercises in meditating with Scripture. That's been one of the premises all week, and I think one of the unique contributions of Christian meditation, of faithfulness, and even of our Lutheran tradition is that the Word, that living in the Word is the initiator of our response called prayer or meditation or contemplation. So we'll spend some time talking about how that has been part of a prayerful life and do a little of it. We haven't done much this week except sit and listen to me or talk to one another, so we'll try some things tomorrow. Okay, thank you.